Hello, I'm Stacy A., and I have the honor and the privilege of interviewing Carl M. at Lumpkin Street Noontimers on December the 18th at 11:05. Okay, Carl, the first question is, please tell me about your life before you found AA, when and where you were born, and just some of your childhood memories.
You want me to start it yet? Mm-hmm. Well, my date of birth is July 28th, 1933, born in Parson County, North Carolina, grew up in Orange County, same county with Chapel Hill, grew up on a tobacco farm, was chewing tobacco when I was 5 and 6 years old, started smoking in front of my parents when I was 12 or 13. My first drunk, I was 8 years old, drank some homebrew, liked the feeling of it, went back to the barrel, drank another glass, and I remember nothing else the rest of that day. So the first time I drank, I loved it and overdid it. As a student, I didn't drink a lot. If I found somebody's jar of moonshine or homemade beer, I would sneak a little. And as a kid growing up, I didn't want to be a farmer, so I decided I would go to graduate school, go to college. My dad didn't have the money to pay for it, so I had to work my way through college. Went to Mars Hill Baptist Junior College for 2 years. Grades were good enough to stay out of the Korean War. Transferred from junior college to Duke University to finish up my 2 years. I was planning to teach high school biology, but my profs encouraged me to go to graduate school. So I went to Rutgers and got a master's in PhD and graduated when I was 25 years old and got married, and our first child was born. I didn't do a lot of drinking while I was in college. I just simply didn't have the money to do it. When I did drink, I usually ended up drunk. But when I took my first job at University of Florida in Gainesville, with no debt, and now making some good cash, I started drinking like a goldfish in a fishbowl. I just drank and drank and drank. Immediately began to have problems of drinking too much. I remember one night we had been out on a party and one of my first PhD students had graduated. We were having a party. I was too drunk to drive home and I didn't want to go home, so he stopped at a stoplight. I jumped out of the car, started to run, and he caught me and put me back in the car. He was driving my car, and I got mad and balled up my fist and hit the windshield twice with both hands. And when I got home, my knuckles were torn to shreds. That's what alcohol did to me. It just... But anyway, I was diagnosed as an insulin-dependent diabetic when I was 33 years old. And the doctor told me drinking wasn't a good idea. And I can remember going to a party one night, and I knew I wanted to drink. So I deliberately cheated on what my carb count was, went to the party and drank, came home and checked my sugar, and it was okay. So I had jimmied it around so that I could drink and prove that I wouldn't over-carb myself to death. So for the next 12 years, I drank with abandon, to the point that my wife finally asked me one day, "Carl, if you can't come home sober today, I wish you would just move out." So I walked out of our house, left her and two teenage boys without giving them a thought, because I needed to drink worse. And I got to the point where I'd come out of the house, I wanted to go to work. Car would go right if I go to work, but it always went left to go to the nearest package store so I could get two cans of beer, cursing myself all the way down. "Why are you doing this?" I drank one can of beer, and my thought was, "Oh, hell, you screwed up today. You can quit tomorrow," which then gave me the privilege of continued to drinking that day. And that went on and on and on until I had run into problems with the police, with driving with no license. I wasn't arrested, but I was given a ticket for driving with no license. And I began to think about suicide, because I wanted to quit, but I couldn't quit. I'd always said I liked drinking. If I wanted to quit, I'd quit. And when I finally got to the point I wanted to quit, I found out I couldn't quit. And I'd worked out a suicide plan. But the only way I could commit suicide would be to do it drunk. And somehow my mind was clear as a crystal. That night, it realized every drink I'd ever taken, I willingly poured it down my throat and blamed my wife for it. And bless her heart, I didn't know her until I was 25 years old. I had a serious drinking problem before I met her. But that night I could realize that it was my problem, and I couldn't quit drinking, and I wanted off the merry-go-round. And I'd been damning God for years. It was GD this and GD that. That night, in absolute desperation, I said a simple prayer: "God, I can't quit drinking. I want off this merry-go-round. Would you please help?" I went to sleep. I woke up, and I haven't had a drink since. And then I started seriously going to AA. went for a year trying to stay sober for my first wife. And I was picking up white chips every day or every week. I can't stay sober for someone else.
Where did you go to your first meeting?
The first meeting was, my first meeting, I think, was at the Biscayne Room.
And when was that about?
I would have been in about June the 10th, 1975.
Okay, tell me a little about working through the steps in the beginning and what that was like, your first few days of learning of the AA way.
Well, my first sponsor was Cobbett. He always gave his full name. He said his name was Andy Brown and that he had been in AA on two or three occasions. He just never cared for it. But when I got to AA, he had 3 years of sobriety, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And when it got to the point where we were beginning to go through the fourth step, I told him that my dad and I had a homosexual affair when I was a young kid. And he said, "Whoa," he says, "I don't know anything about what you're talking about. I don't know anyone in AA around here that has dealt with it that I can send you to." But he says, "I got opinions like hell about what you're talking about, but I have no experience in it." So he turned me loose and let me go. He didn't demand that I talk to him anymore, but we still remained friends, and I talked with him. But 5 years later, I was remarried, and about to commit suicide, and we went and talked to an Episcopal minister about our marriage, and he sent us to a good marriage counselor that helped us put the marriage back together. But he said, "Carl, I have a therapy group starting next week. I wish you would join it." And for some reason, I said, "Okay." So for once a day a week, for 1 hour and 50 minutes, I was one of about 5 people in the therapy group with him. And his way of handling it was, "Who needs to talk today?" And no one else would talk, and I started to talk. And I talked through that homosexual affair and all that, and 1 year later, I walked out a free man. That used to embarrass me to tears for people to know that I had done such a thing. It no longer frightens me. It's one of the biggest gifts that I have to offer people in AA. There are things in our lives that we don't really want to bring out, but it certainly, once I did all that, my dress code changed. Before that, I dressed in drab clothes. I didn't want to be seen. And I see people wearing red. I said, "Look at that SOB. He's trying to show off." What I would say, "God, I wish I could do that." Red is, can you believe, red is my favorite color. And if you see me without red, you know I'm sick.
That's special to me because my daughter Chloe her favorite color is red also. So that's really special to me that you shared that part. Tell me a little bit about AA's reputation in the community. How is it different than it is now?
Well, it seemed like every time when I first got here, it was nowhere near as large as activity as it is today. There were four groups in town. Three of them are still existing. And that was me, New Freedom, the Biscayne, and the Easy Desert. Those are the three main groups. There was another one that sort of folded very quickly after I got here. The main difference, you'd be in a meeting with 10 to 15 people instead of 30, 40, 50, up to 100 or more. And everybody sat in a circle. The chairman would offer a topic, and they would either say, "We're going to go left or right," and everyone was to say their name, like, "I'm Carl Monk," or "I'm Carl C., and I pass," or "share." And it went around, and if it got around and power was still, then there was some dialogue back and forth. But everyone at least had to say their name and that they were an alcoholic. And when they stood to say the Serenity Prayer or the Lord's Prayer, they did not hold hands. They just stood up in a circle and recited whatever the closing prayer was. They began to hold hands after someone had gone somewhere else, and they held hands, so they came back, and we became copycats, and we began to hold hands.
So what was the perception of AA's success in the general population when you were first introduced? So how has that perception changed, the community? How did they perceive AA and the groups that were being held?
You mean the...
the general community, the outside of AA. What was the perception back then?
Ever since I've been in, I haven't run into anyone who has had any derogatory remarks to make toward what Alcoholics Anonymous is doing. I just haven't run into that.
Have you had, do you have any knowledge of how many meetings were in existence? I know you said four in Athens, but in general, do you have any knowledge of the existence of other groups around?
Yeah, there was a group in Wanda. There was a group in Commerce. There was a group in Monroe. There was a group in Watkinsville. There was a group in Greensboro. There was a group in what's that little town between here and Washington?
Rail.
Okay. And so you kind of explained a little bit about the formats of how they used to do AA in the early meetings. Is there anything else about how they were run that you can think of, how the format was? Anything else?
Well, at the old Biscayne Room, when I first got here, they had a place there. The hospitals just didn't deal with drunks. And they had a understand that they would allow, if someone had someone who was coming off of a drunk and they thought he might have interest in AA, they would carry him there, and as long as they could have two people with him, he could stay there up to 3 days. And they had juice and stuff in the refrigerator that he would be able to, when he got to the point where he could drink, where he could eat a little something, he could at least take a little nourishment by drinking a little juice. So I remember them sitting with a guy one day with another soap alcoholic. And this guy came in drunk and he went into a seizure. He stretched out just as stiff as a board, urinated in his pants. Then a few seconds later, he came to and he looked at you like he'd never seen you before. Absolutely nothing up in his brain. And he slowly began to come out of this from that seizure.
So tell me a little bit about your experiences sponsoring others.
Well, that's something that I sort of got started a little late with me, because I was having so much difficulty with me and that affair I had with my dad. One of the things that helped is that when I got through with that therapy, I was at something called a serenity retreat at the Catholic monastery over in Conyers. And that on Saturday night, it was a mixture of AA and Al-Anon. And that Saturday night, they were going to have a speaker, and they asked me if I would share my story. And I said, yeah. And I started talking, and some 3 to 5 minutes in the talk, I kept hearing this little voice in the back of my head, you are going to need to deal with that affair you had with your dad. And I wasn't sure what to say. And I continued to talk, and a few minutes later I just simply said one thing that had haunted me for a long time had been this homosexual affair I had with my dad when I was 10 to 12. That's all I said, and I continued. I don't have enough fingers and toes to count the people who have, because I've been willing to share that from the speaker podium. People would come, Carl says, I'm dealing with that. Why now? How did you do that? So something that I thought at one time was a curse, I look at it now as a blessing, because of all the people that have come and says, how did you get to the point where you could say what you said in front of the book? It's amazing what God can do once you get sober and can be honest. no longer embarrasses me. If it bothers you, that's your problem. It doesn't bother me. So it's just, it's, I'm free to be me today. I don't have anything in me that I haven't shared with somebody. And I think that's what AA has been the biggest help for me. It's helped me to be me for the first time in my life. But I had to go through all that junk to deal with what I had to deal with.
So sponsee relationships created out of that, were created out of all of your sharing and being so honest about what happened.
Yeah. And I have a lot of people have come up and asked me to sponsor because of what I said about that homosexual affair. And I've had some ladies talk to me about things that they were dealing with because of similar type thing, because they felt I was safe.
Tell me what you thought about the big book back then, and did you use it?
More than I do now. I rarely ever look in the big book. I do when I started sponsoring one. I just got through reading it because I started sponsoring a couple of guys about almost 9 months ago. One of them fired me because I wasn't going fast enough. He wanted to do all 12 steps in 3 weeks. And I said, I can't do it. It's too fast. So he fired me. And I said, that's fine. And we're still friends.
I understand a little of that because I did the same thing that person did, and boy, did I learn from that, that that was not the right way to do it, that I really needed to take my time, and I'm working on them for the third time because of that.
Well, it's a never-ending job.
Right.
It's a never-ending job. Mm-hmm.
During the early years of your recovery, how did the, well, I think I already asked this, how the community received Alcoholics Anonymous. Is there anything else you want to add to that before we move on?
No, I don't have anything.
Okay. What about the early conferences or conventions that you may have gone to? Did you go to any conferences or conventions that you could share anything about?
I know the first one I went to was in Albany. I think that's where they had the state convention. And the thing that I remember about it most is I went into the bathroom down one where the meeting was and went into the stall, and lo and behold, there was an empty whiskey bottle. And I thought, this is odd. There's an AA group and there's an empty whiskey bottle. But I don't think, knowing drunks, that's not unusual.
Okay, so what about the General Service Conference? Do you have anything you want to share about that from the earlier years?
The which conference?
The GS, the General Service Conference, or the General Service Office. Anything that you want to share about that from the early days that you have any knowledge of or memory of?
Not enough to say anything.
And anything else that you want to change, you want to share on the changes of AA as it was before and how it is now before we wrap up? Anything else that you can think of about that?
I think the biggest problem that I have right now is the groups are too darn large. People can come and hide, and we've got groups. This group here at Lumpkin Street, Noontimers, there's a half a dozen or more people who come in and sit down say nothing, get up and leave, and I haven't heard them open their mouth. You can hide on a group where you've got so many people, and we have the same people share day after day after day after day, and you can almost predict when they go talk.
I agree with that. I've seen somebody go back out in my home group who never shared, and I felt like there was a correlation to that sharing and staying sober. Yeah. Sounds like you agree with that.
Yeah. And another thing is that there's no doubt that alcoholics, a lot of them are drug addicts too. And there's a lot of groups who tried to blend alcoholism and drug addiction under AA, and that goes against the traditions. It clearly states alcohol. There is an NA meeting, but a lot of the people in NA, they want to, all of them, most of them have alcohol problems. They want to come to AA and talk about both of them. And you're constantly having to make people mad to tell them you're welcome here, but leave your drugs somewhere else. Go to NA. And they get mad. They want to go one shop home. And I suspect, I know this group done by and of that.
Is there anything you tell me about your home groups? Which home groups have you been a part of?
Easy Does It was my home group originally. They met at that time at about 8 o'clock at night. Because people would get off of work, come home, take a shower, eat, and come to a meeting. And then they would have about a half an hour at the coffee pot, and then they'd have the meeting, and then they'd go home. And Easy Does It was at the Emmanuel Episcopal Church. And at this, during the winter, it is dark as Hades in there. And the women stopped coming because they were uncomfortable walking into shadows where they couldn't see if there were people sleeping behind the bushes. So we started trying to get move the meeting time to an earlier date. And we had 4 to 6 group conscious meetings. And some would agree to go to 7:30, some to 7. But you couldn't get where everybody was in the same page. And one night, while we were in group conscious, a young college kid said, "Well, some of us are happy with this. If there's some that's not pleased with this, why don't they go form another group?" I wanted to punch him in the nose. The next day, riding around Athens, I thought, that guy's right. So we got together, and about 8 or 9 of us left, went to St. James, and started the Turning Point group that started at 7 o'clock at night. And guess what happened? Every group in town began to meet earlier and earlier.
Wow.
So we started that group. And the lady that actually came up with the name Turning Point died just within the last couple of months. She was a group that lived here in Athens. And we were that group until we had 2 meetings a week.
They got so big.
Huh?
They got so big
we wanted to have 2 meetings every night. And one of our good members that show up here from time to time got a dog and no, got all her sponsors to come in. So that's when Bobby and I and several others moved and went to start How It Works. And they stayed, and they still don't have 2 meetings on every night. It's partly because they use that big room upstairs. And I was at State at How It Works until I got to the point where I physically was a liability on the road driving at night. So that's when I started coming to Lumpkin Street during the daytime.
And how long has that been?
I have a hard time saying. I feel like I've been coming at least 10 years.
Oh, okay.
But, then 2 years ago, I lost the sight of my right eye altogether. And now I do no driving at all, because I only see the hole about a couple of inches. Very, very limited vision. Just enough that with a Kindle, where I can enlarge my word, I can read all day long, which is a blessing, because I'd go crazy if I couldn't read. I can't sit and twiddle my thumbs all day.
Well, you make it to a lot of AA meetings, because I know I see you there. And I just want to close by saying how honored I am that I had the privilege of interviewing you, and that I know you've changed a lot of lives in Athens, Georgia, and probably other places too. And I do see men honor you by sitting next to you, one on your left and your right, sometimes with the red on that you wear. And I think that's such an honor that they love you and just want to honor you and respect you for all that you've done in their lives. And I just appreciate the time that you've spent with me today.
You're more than welcome.